This is Nancy Clare, and welcome to episode 16 of Speaking of Mysteries. This week, Les Klinger, with a cameo by yours truly, interviews Lindsay Fay, the author of Dust and Shadow, a Sherlock Holmes versus Jack the Ripper novel, the Edgar Award-nominated The Gods of Gotham, and its sequel, Seven for a Secret. The interview, which is really great, is a bit on the longish side, so I'll keep this intro appropriately short. Because Lindsay is so very eloquent, there's absolutely nothing I can add. I do want to mention, though, that Lindsay is writing for Volume 2 of Watson and Holmes, the Eisner-nominated, Glyph Award-winning African-American Sherlock Holmes graphic story collection, which is in the middle of its Kickstarter fundraising campaign. In fact, she's featured on the Kickstarter video. So I would encourage fans of Lindsay's, fans of all things Sherlock and Watson, fans of graphic novels, and everyone else to go directly to Kickstarter or visit the Speaking of Mysteries website at speakingofmysteries.com, where we will have a link. Follow the link and contribute. You'll be glad you did.
Welcome to another podcast of Speaking of Mystery. This is Les Klinger, and I'm joined tonight by Nancy Clare.
Oh, I'm here. Hi.
And our special guest today is Lindsay Fay, all the way from New York City.
New York City? Yes, yes, here I am. And I am, may I say, honored to be on your podcast, sir. And ma'am, thank you so much for having me.
Well, it's great to have you here. You are now, it's hard to believe, to think of you now as a veteran author. Because I knew you when.
Okay, by when? If you mean when I had published...
Nothing.
Nothing? Yeah, absolutely. Snake Eyes. I think initially you and I met, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I approached you because I had written a Sherlock Holmes pastiche, and I knew where my bread was buttered, and I could not get anything wrong. And I said, I want every Sherlockian in the world to look at this and see no just strange, crazy errors. And I think I just emailed you out of the blue and said, would you read my thing? And you very kindly said that you would.
Well, that's not my recollection, but that's okay. I don't remember being kind, but I do remember. Actually, I think we met at the Baker Studio Regulars weekend at one of the
concert parties. No, it was after first. You had read my book, though.
That may be. In any event, so that leads us to my first question, which is, why did you do this? Why did you get started as a writer? You were an actor, mm-hmm. and doing that other noble acting type profession, waiting tables.
Yes.
How did you get into writing?
The restaurant I was working at got knocked down and turned into an Apple store, and that's probably
without your permission.
Without my permission, no, we lost our lease. It was a beautiful restaurant, and it has, in fact, since reopened. If anyone wants to go to have brilliant Belgian food, you should go to Markt, M-A-R-K-T.
Do they have a plaque on the wall now commemorating this is where Lindsay Fay got her start?
No, but they were so wonderful to me, and it was just this strange, series. It was a series of very fortunate events. That's what it was. So I had always been... completely obsessed with storytelling. And I guess that's where it comes back to both the acting and the writing. I like stories. I like understanding people better. I like hearing about extraordinary things ordinary people do. I like about hearing ordinary things that extraordinary people do. I like all of those things. I like hearing stories. My parents, when I was growing up, they read to me incessantly from when I was a kid. I loved Lord of the Rings. I loved the Sherlock Holmes mysteries. I loved all kinds of the Chronicles of Narnia, all these great narratives, right, that were limitless in scope. And when I was an actor, I was often auditioning in rooms, you know, sort of you walk in there and there's a table of people and they're deciding whether or not you have just done something amazing or you haven't. And I eventually hit the wall where I felt like I had absolutely no autonomy whatsoever over my own career. Now, if I'd been a smart actor, what I would have said is, I'm going to put together my own cabaret. I'm going to write a one-woman show, and I'm going to, you know, perform in it. I'm going to cast my friends and start a theater company, and we're all going to be badass. I could have been Steppenwolf. It never occurred to me to take that kind of control over my own career. So when this restaurant got, knocked over and replaced by beautiful iPhones, I turned back to something that I have always loved, which is a storytelling in a different format. So it was an act of enormous hubris that I embarked on this in the first place, because I had been reading, I've always read Sherlock Holmes, and I've always read Sherlock Holmes pastiches and fan fiction. Like, I love the really, really great stuff, and I love the really, really bad stuff, because it's so much of it is so much fun to read. But I was reading Sherlock Holmes versus Jack the Ripper material specifically on a break at another restaurant where I got hired after that. And it just seemed like the author was throwing, I call it kitchen sink syndrome. It's actually a great book, but this person was like doing the same thing that many other people have done with Sherlock Holmes and Jack the Ripper, which is to say, yes, Sherlock Holmes, Jack the Ripper plus Freemasons, or Sherlock Holmes, Jack the Ripper plus the royal family, or Sherlock Holmes, Jack the Ripper plus Satanists in this case. And what kind of distressed me was that I wanted to read a book where Sherlock Holmes and Jack the Ripper went head to head. And what was frightening about it was that you were trying to track a serial killer pre-Freud and pre-organized forensics. And so that was the book I wanted to read. And for some bizarre reason, I decided that I was going to sit down while I was on unemployment and I was going to write it. I had already sort of started it and plotted it, but I finished it while I was out of work. And you could have knocked me over with a feather when somebody bought it, because that was not something that I ever expected to happen.
So this started really as a Sherlockian endeavor. You didn't say to yourself, I'm going to be a mystery writer.
Exactly. Yeah, I mean, it was a completely Sherlockian endeavor. I wanted to read the book where Sherlock Holmes, I wanted to read the Caleb Carr version of Sherlock Holmes and Jack the Ripper, where it's just very raw and real. And I consulted a number of prominent Ripperologists when I wrote the book. I talked personally with Donald Rumbelow. I talked with Stuart P. Evans.
I remember being very impressed, not only by your Sherlockian expertise, but that you got all the Ripper details right.
Thank you. I appreciate that, because that was the other part of it that I thought was missing. And there's a sort of, I don't know if people notice it or not, but there's a strong feminist sort of, you know, undercurrent to my work. And I thought at a certain point in reading so many hyperbolic, I guess, Sherlock Holmes versus Jack the Ripper narratives, and I love them, don't get me wrong, I think they're great. I just thought that additionally, these women, what happened to them, let's look at it. Let's look at what actually happened to them, as opposed to imagining that it was a vampire or that Jack.
What's wrong with vampires?
I love vampires. I love them. But this is, I wanted to bring an element of realism into it. And so I consulted Ripperologists and I consulted you. I don't think, you know, what's interesting is that I was very proud of myself after you and I had a conversation, because I remember there were a few things that you said, okay, this is a little bit off, because it was something to do with Mycroft and the chronology, how Watson wouldn't have known Mycroft was the British government at that time. But I was really proud of my Sherlockian material at that time. But then with the Ripperology, I had to consult people. And I do that now continually. The research element is extremely important to me, because I wanted to convey that real, that visceral, the world as it actually was, if Holmes and Watson had been the protagonists of this particular story.
Well, in Dust and Shadow, which is the
I was just going to say, we need to mention the title here. We're talking about that book, so.
In Dust and Shadow, you have a really strong female character assisting Sherlock Holmes. And I'm wondering how the Sherlockians reacted to that. And I'll throw that question over to Les.
Well, I mean, Sherlockians are not male chauvinist pigs, by and large. There are some exceptions, as there are in every community, but no, I mean, the book was wonderfully well received by the Sherlockians because it was so carefully done.
Have had nothing but great feedback from Sherlockians, but Nancy, I should speak to this question very briefly, because from Sherlockians, I think, and Les, I imagine will back me up here. They've been nothing but very sweet to me, and I drop a lot of Easter eggs, you know, in Dust and Shadow because I think that's fun. Mm-hmm. Regarding Marianne Monk, the only unfair review I've ever gotten from anyone ever, I mean, like, I have gotten 1-star reviews for, and don't, you know, everyone reads their reviews, come on. But I've gotten 1-star reviews that were perfectly fair. And I said, yep, wow, you nailed me on that one. That is absolutely true. But the only unfair review I've ever gotten was about Marianne Monk. And Marianne Monk was a character in the novel because she was a real woman. She was the actual person who identified in the police records her friend Polly. And I took someone out of history, and I think that a lot of people who write historical fiction, they enjoy giving voices to people who wouldn't have had voices at the time. So I thought that this woman who had been at the workhouse with Polly and had Polly Nichols and had been friends with her and who cared about her and who gave a lot of sass to the cops, because that's what happened. I thought turning her into a character who works with Holmes and Watson would be amazing. And I got this one review from a person who said, well, this would have been a great book, but it had a Mary Sue in it. Now, I don't know how much you know about Mary Sues, but essentially it's like a female author inserting herself into a narrative in the guise of a person where she doesn't belong. Essentially, like, that's suggesting that I think I would like to hang out with Holmes and Watson and or, you know, make out with them. So I'm going to create a plucky, smart character, and I am going to, you know, put all of me into that character. And the reason the accusation of self-insertion was so frustrating from this reviewer was that it was completely 100% true. I am deeply guilty of self-inserting regarding Dust and Shadow, because I've wanted to be John Watson since I was 10. And I wanted just so badly to be the person who carried the service revolver for the genius friend who, you know, creates for you this ridiculous world of adventures and danger and, you know, excitement for your whole life, for decades and decades. And I love John Watson. He's my favorite character. So yes, I did insert myself into that narrative, but in a gender sense, it was very interesting to see that this reviewer automatically assumed that I had inserted myself into, you know, the female character that I hadn't necessarily invented from whole cloth. She was a real person. But I was like, yeah, I inserted myself into this. I want to be John Watson.
Well, who doesn't?
Who doesn't? So me writing a Mary Sue is a little bit of a strange strange criticism, but that's the only unfair one I've ever had.
Well, let's flash forward. You took a really... I mean, after you've written a brilliant Sherlockian pastiche, you did something even more bold. You tried your hand at a mystery novel. Now, I happen to have read your next effort, which wasn't published. You let that one slide, and then you went on to do something even more daring, which was to do something that required, what, incredible amount of research and dialect, Gods of Gotham, which got nominated for an Edgar and lots of recognition, was just a startlingly mature piece of work, Lindsay, and... Oh. A bold step in a new direction. Where did that come from?
Well, it came from the fact that I had been sort of, I'd been kind of, and you know, you're right. I had written a couple of books that were not destined to see the light of day yet. I still like.
Yet? Absolutely. That's, you know, you put them away for a couple years and you go back to them.
Then you go back to them and then you make them better. But I think the problem with them was that I was still hung up on this idea that I needed to write something that was both adventurous and artistic and smart. I had all of these hurdles, right, that I was meant to get over. And finally, what I realized when I sat down to write The Gods of Gotham was this. I love Sherlock Holmes and John Watson, and that was what I put into that book. And when I was creating these other narratives and these other characters, there was always this sort of, I had the bit between my teeth a little bit where I thought to myself, you have to make this not so visceral. You have to make it more artistic. You have to make it more artful. It can't be quite as raw. It can't be quite this accessible. You need to, all this, that's nonsense. That's just nonsense. So I think I got over a lot of the nonsense because nobody was interested. And if I had written those books in a really passionate way, then maybe people would have purchased them and read them. When I set out to write The Gods of Gotham, I said, okay, people only care about your writing when you're tearing your heart off your sleeve and slapping it on the keyboard. And I decided to make a narrator who in many ways is like Sherlock Holmes, but who in other ways is completely unlike Sherlock Holmes. He's very poetic. Timothy Wilde is very passionate. He's in love from the moment you meet him, desperately in love with this unattainable woman, or previously attainable, but after the fire that scars him, he thinks she's unattainable. He's extremely bright, but he's also of the opinion that doesn't matter. He's not arrogant in the way that I love Sherlock Holmes's arrogance, but Timothy is very humble. He's small. I made all of these decisions deliberately to take Tim Wilde in a different direction than Sherlock Holmes, because I thought, what would it look like if I created a narrator who, first of all, it's the narrator who is the brilliant one, and that's hard. That's really difficult.
Right. So there's nobody saying, that's really brilliant, Tim.
Exactly. That's rough. So I tried to switch it from the brilliant character being the one who's watched into the brilliant character being the narrator. And then the brilliant character is in love and he's 5'4" and, you know, he's scrappy and he doesn't think much of himself. And, you know, all of these things were a deliberate walk away from Sherlock Holmes. And the reason I did that was because I think that I wanted to see if it would work, but also I had this very high concept, which was day one, cop one of the NYPD. And I thought, if you can make that work, just day one, the first cop out of the doors with a star badge, that would be great if you could actually nail that. And the only reason I managed to do that was because I was writing passionately and I realized that nobody cares. And I watched a Shakespeare in the Park production that summer. And this is completely relevant because I realized, what are you doing waffling around with trying to make your sentences, you know, artful and complicated? People in Shakespeare, they wail, they bellow, they scream, they laugh, they guffaw, they cry, they you know, do all of these things very unabashedly, and we're still watching these plays. I was like, why are you filtering all of that? You feel all of these things, so why are you filtering them? So from the minute I started to really write from my gut, it started going a lot better.
So, Lindsay, I don't want to spend a lot of time talking about Seven for a Secret, which, audience, is Lindsay's next book in the Tim Wilde series, which is out and is wonderful.
If you don't mind my saying it, on August 5th, Tuesday, August 5th, the paperback is released.
Okay. But we're hard-driving investigative journalists, so we have tough questions. Things like, what's next? That's what we want to know.
Gotcha, journalism. What I'm working on now is not what is next. So what is next is the third book in what I hesitate to say, but is true. And yes, people can react to this however they like, is the Timothy Wilde trilogy. So the Timothy Wilde trilogy, the third book, is going to be coming out in May 2015.
Great. So that's done. And that's turned in. Is there a title yet?
It's called The Fatal Flame, and that was a much tossed around title, but The Fatal Flame ended up being the perfect, like, viscerally interesting, but also alliterative as the other ones are. It fit in the whole package. So I do mean to tell people that, it's not my intention to say that I'm never going to write anything about the Wilde brothers ever again, but the Timothy Wilde books are a trilogy, and the third one is going to be out in May 2015. And it is done and dusted. It's copy edited to death. It's in second pass pages at this point. So what's really interesting about, you know, the book writing industry is that you don't have the delay like you do on a film, obviously, where it's going to be years of post-production, but you do have a solid, I mean, I think it's going to be like a year and a half between books, but it's not that I didn't write it. It's just that it's not, you know, in production yet. So apologies to anybody who's waiting for that book, but it'll be out soon in spring.
So what are you working on?
I'm working on, well, I won't delve too far into it, but I'll ask you a question. Imagine you were a young person, a girl, who was reading.
Okay, I was going to say, I am a young person, but so the
I
girl
part. I know you are a young girl. Yes. Imagine you're a young girl. In 1847, and you're reading the infamous second edition of Jane Eyre. Imagine if, as you're reading this infamous sort of second edition with the prologue of Jane Eyre, you had been through many of the same things and had been told over and over again, you're wicked, you're bad, you're trouble, you're irredeemable, you're devil-ridden, you're a horrid, horrid person, and you're going to burn in hell. And instead of, as Jane Eyre does, saying, no, I understand that my own moral compass is solid. I don't need to question it. I know that I'm a good person. Imagine if she instead said, huh, I could own that. I think the best way to describe it is it's Jane Eyre sort of meets darkly dreaming Dexter.
Well, so what I want to observe here is that this doesn't seem to be a mystery. And I want to talk about that. I mean, you obviously do not perceive yourself as a genre author.
Well, I do in some senses. I've only ever written thrillers, and this is a thriller, definitely. It's also part noir, but there's a lot of murder in it.
Okay.
So, it's covered in murder. I set up the sort of moral equation at the beginning, but the final line of the prologue is, reader, I murdered him.
I mean, certainly there are those who see Jane Eyre as a thriller, but I think that's a little extreme. So this is...
No, there's not more dead people in this one.
This is the sequel to Jane Eyre. Okay.
No, it's not the sequel. It's somebody who's reading Jane Eyre who makes decisions. Yeah.
Well, this sounds like more bold, new material from you, and it's very exciting to hear this.
And I'm kind of excited about it for not only the fact that this is a fun new standalone book, and that I'm writing someone different, and that I'm creating new people, and it's always really interesting to meet them. And I know that sounds weird, but it's very fun. I've never written a novel in a female narrator before. And that's going to be my
challenging.
Well, no, actually, I mean, I'm a girl. It shouldn't be.
Yeah, I would think it would be less challenging. So, Lindsay, you know, the disgusting part, the part that I hate about you is that you're now 32.
Oh, no, I'm 34.
Oh, my God. You got older when I wasn't looking. You're 34. Oh, 34. Thank God you're 34. So. Mm-hmm. Do you see yourself doing this for another 30 years, 40 years, 50 years?
Well,
yeah. Do you have a lot of stories to tell? Does it give you the satisfaction that you want to keep going and just keep turning them out one every couple of years and all that?
Well, I have two answers to that. First of all, yeah, however long I live, I don't like being idle. It's bad for me as a person. So I think that this is the perfect thing for me to do, and I am so lucky and privileged that people actually read them and that they enjoy them and that I've gotten good feedback from them. I love that. And I can't imagine at this point doing anything else. At the same time, I think the question of creativity is an interesting one, because I always find myself, you know, running into these cultural cul-de-sacs and historical anecdotes and finding these things that are very interesting, and suddenly they seem like they're a story.
Rapture. Wow. I know it so well.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's that aspect of it where it's just total research rapture. And then there are other things that I do that are completely dissimilar. Like I'm a guest writer for the Watson and Holmes.
Well, comics. I want to get to that. I was going to say, I won't
introduce it yet then, yeah. But like, I have all kinds of, there are a lot of ways that when I encounter potential stories, I tie them, and I try very specifically to do this, that I tie them to things that are going on during the modern era that frankly piss me off. And so some of the feminism in my books and some of the you know, emphasis on racial disparity and some of the emphasis on religious infighting and some of the emphasis on, you know, family and ways families are fraught and they don't understand each other and problems with addiction and problems with, you know, all sorts of things. Those are very personal, and I find them to be better in my own life when I have somewhere to put them. And I think that for that reason, if for no other reason, I can't imagine not being a writer of mystery stories.
So,
and I have a bunch of ideas too.
Well, great. So, to sort of wrap this up, I wanted to talk about one more subject, which is your comic book writing. So you have now taken on writing comic books, and not only comic books. I mean, on the one hand, people might say, well, yeah, it's another Sherlock Holmes thing, but it's a black Sherlock Holmes experience. We're talking about the comic book Watson and Holmes. Why did it interest you doing it, and how is it different, and what do you feel about it?
Here's what happened. I was commissioned to write about 4 years ago a 6-part Sherlock Holmes comic book that has not come to fruition yet because it all sort of, the production element of it fell apart. I would still like to see it happen. I'm shopping it around to various people, and it was essentially my version of Reichenbach, and it had kind of occasionally steampunky elements, but like by and large, it was a very traditional Sherlockian narrative of three previously unpublished cases. I think it was the Camberwell poisoning case. And then the Peridol Chamber, and then the Isle of Uffa. Those were the three cases, and they were, I was going to do them in sort of double issues, or, you know, 1 through 6, or do them in a whole graphic novel, but there were three cases, essentially, that ended up explaining the story of why Reichenbach happened the way it did, which is to say, terribly. So, I had written that, and I loved the format, and I had been asked to do it, you know, by a comic book company. And then after that fell through, I realized I really just enjoyed the genre.
It's very different. I mean, from what I know about it, it's very different from writing books.
It is, but it's so... I've been told my books are cinematic, and it's very cinematic because what you're doing is jump cutting a lot, and I do that already. So, you know... You're not talking to Vladimir Nabokov here. Like, I write stuff that has a lot of, you know, very filmic scene breaks. So I found it naturally really fun to do that. And after it had been written but didn't go anywhere, I actually was commissioned by Nancy, who I think we lost Nancy. But Nancy asked whether I would do an 8-page comic for L.A. Noir.
Right.
And of course, I immediately said, yes, I would love to. And I thought that it turned out really, you know,
This was for Noir magazine, which was a tablet-based magazine that Nancy edited.
Correct. So it was for Noir magazine, which was it only in tablet form?
Yes. Yes, only tablet, which is perhaps why it failed, but who knows?
Possibly. I don't know. I just know that I enjoyed the heck out of writing that 8-pager. So what happened was I had been, I'm a member of the Baker Street Babes, and we had been proselytizing because we just love their work so much. We had been trying to signal boost all of the Watson and Holmes material already. And we interviewed them on the podcast, etc. So at a certain point, after I had nerded out about Sherlock Holmes, various aspects of Sherlock Holmes enough times, they asked me to guest write an issue or two. And I was so thrilled by this. It was like, you know, they're Glyph Award winning at this point.
They're great. Right. I don't recall. Did they win? I don't know, but they were nominated for an Eisner, and it's just wonderful stuff.
Wonderful stuff. They were nominated for 2 Eisner Awards. They did not win, but they are currently launching a Kickstarter for the Volume 2 collection of Watson and Holmes. Now, I love so many things about them. I love that Watson has top billing. I mean, it's my favorite character in the Sherlock Holmes mysteries, and suddenly he has top billing. I love the dynamic that they write. I love that it's set entirely in Harlem. I love that I used to live up there. I lived in Washington Heights with my husband for almost 10 years, and it's just a very familiar territory for me, and they knew that. So after I had been corresponding with them about all kinds of, you know, publicity-related stuff, they said, well, you write comics. You should guest write for us. And I said, like, really? Like, in a really high voice.
Okay.
So I wrote a one-off first, which is just a single-issue, 22-pager classic that is The Solitary Cyclist, and essentially my version of the modern Watson and Holmes Solitary Cyclist. And then they asked me if I wanted to do the Irene Adler arc. And that was when I really lost it, because I was like, you want me to sit down and write... You want a feminist to write Irene Adler?
There we go. So the title of it is Baker Street Babe?
Oh, no. I don't think we have a title yet. That one's still being worked through. But I can tell you a few things about how I've worked with them, because it will answer some questions that maybe people would be troubled by. I don't write the dialogue word for word. What happens is it's very collaborative with Watson and Holmes. So what I do is I write out a very specific panel by panel storyboard with the gist of what people say to each other and the jokes that happen. But any sort of modern New York City urban dialect that happens, I don't write. Yep. So if anybody's troubled by that idea.
Okay. Well, that's a relief.
That's not me. What I do is I essentially storyboard the whole thing, and then I send it to all of them. And then these guys are very collaborative, and it's a totally different process than I've had with other comic books. So then they go through it and they say, okay, I think this page could be tweaked a bit. I think that maybe if we made this a secret until later, that would be better. So if we could hide that panel and forget that one. And all of their suggestions have been fantastic. None of this is going to exist in print unless people fund the Kickstarter, though.
Well,
and the Kickstarter is running now.
So go, fans. We're happy to plug. It's on Kickstarter. It's Watson and Holmes, and the publishers are?
New Paradigm Studios. And New Paradigm Studios, you could definitely find the Kickstarter if you were to enter that search term. But Watson and Holmes Volume 2 on Google will also bring it up. Or if you go on Kickstarter and just search for Watson and Holmes, I'm sure it would appear. They overfunded their last Kickstarter because people were super enthusiastic about it. This one needs the same kind of support because it's not there yet. And what they want to do is put together the next printed volume, and then what they want to do is be able to produce my version of Irene Adler. And
who doesn't want to see that?
I hope people want to see that.
Absolutely.
I'm really happy to write her.
Absolutely. Well, Lindsay, it's been great to have you on the show. Thank you so much. And people, go buy 7 for a Secret, because you can buy that now. And be waiting for, there's a title for the next book. Remind me again. It's
The Fatal Flame.
The Fatal Flame, out next spring. Lindsay, thanks so much for being on the show. We wish you great fortune, and we'll be looking for comics, novels, and Jane Eyre.
Les, it was absolutely my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
Next week, we'll continue with the second in our 2-part series on mysteries that feature fixers, when we talk to Roger Hobbs about his much-nominated first thriller, Ghost Man. Until then, this is Nancy Clare. Thank you again for joining us on Speaking of Mysteries.